So we're staying where we were in the previous presentation, in this growing prayer of union. John of the Cross has a term for it that we're very familiar with, but I find it quite complex in translation. I won't spend a long time on this. It's sometimes called the dark night of the soul, as distinct from of the senses. Well, it is distinct from the senses. The night of the senses means we're being taken beyond what our imagination and memory and senses can attain. Of course, it's obvious once you say it. Night of the soul. Well, I don't know what you think when you use the word soul, and I tend myself to avoid it. I don't find it helpful. The best meaning for soul that I can get is the American soul music, like longing stuff. I can feel that all right. But sometimes it's where we grew up in a Platonic world theologically, because it was around for a long time. First 1,000 years, people thought in this Neoplatonic so-called way, as though we were a soul in a body. Well, I can't make any sense of that, and if you can, stay with it. So I don't want to use the word soul here, because I don't know what it means, and I don't know what you think it means either. We're one being. The cells of our body are beautiful, receptive and meaningful, and of our mind and of our cortex and all this. We're one being. And what I think John, and we can't say night of the spirit, because spirit is actually a word in the New Testament here kept specially for our relationship with God. Well, our relationship with God can be very intense and beautiful and true. So it's not the spirit, it's not our connection with God that's in the dark. It's me, it's you, it's us. Why? Because we need good theology. Good theology points us towards the mystery. Bad theology points us in another direction, which is going nowhere. So look at good theology, good thoughts about God, good teachings about God that have come down through the tradition. Yes, they point us to the mystery, but they point us to the mystery. Our words, our theology, our thoughts are, of course, fall infinitely short of God. God is beyond all of that. So that's, I think, a little bit of what John is talking about here. As we are drawn and give in to that drawing, of course we have to go into what our mind and will and our very being experiences as darkness. Darkness, but there's a presence in the darkness, but it's darkness. It's beyond all thoughts, all words, all emotions. And I'm going to do this in two parts, now and the first tomorrow morning. We've already reflected on what John of the Cross calls the night of the senses, just to remind you. The gift of contemplative prayer drew us into communion with God beyond the reach of the imagination, memory, or thoughts. Though we were in communion with God in our depth, our consciousness, insofar as it depends upon the senses, couldn't find a place in this communion. We could find a place for our senses and imagination in meditations, particularly on the life of Jesus, of course, but in this we can't. John speaks of the confusion, maybe, and sense of deprivation, maybe, that we experience as a kind of darkness. To trust the gift of prayer being offered us, we have to learn to let go the pleasure we experience through our holy thoughts and feelings of being close to God. We had to learn the discipline of trusting that the communion we were experiencing was what really mattered, and that we were praying in order to be in communion with God, not to feel close to God. In this darkness, the night of the senses, I'm still on here, the introduction, in this darkness we learned to focus on God's action within, without being distracted by our senses, by our memory, and by our imagination, or by the mind searching for understanding. We came to a certain harmony in which our bodies and our senses submitted to our longing to gaze upon God and be united with God in love. With the deepening of contemplation in what Teresa calls the prayer of quiet and the prayer of union, the inflowing of God is experienced. It's not a theory, we experience it. And with it, there's a deep peace and a profound joy, because we're made for it. But we're acutely conscious of the transcendence of God and the distance between our longing, our soul perhaps, and the union with God that we've tasted but don't fully yet enjoy. We feel as though God, who has touched us in such an intimate way, and it is an intimate touch, seems to be withdrawing from us and to be absent. Of course, it's not God that's withdrawing. It's that we have come to a deeper realization of God's transcendence, the real God. And now I move to Jonathan Cross's, I've called it, darkness in the core of our being. The effect of this realization is that our desire deepens, making us capable of more love. It also purifies us of all attachments, making our love more pure. The point upon which we're focusing here is that this can be a painful experience. It's as though we're plunged in darkness in the very centre of our being. We long to see the one who's drawn us into love, but we cannot. No longer is it our senses and the faculties that depend upon them, memory, imagination, that are being purified. Now it's the core of our ego. We're yielding to God who is drawing us, and therefore we're being drawn into a prayer that relies solely on faith. The light with which God illumines us cannot be registered in understanding, our memory, our imagination. We're journeying in the darkness, and that's beautiful, of course, because God's there, the darkness of faith. Divine warmth and fragrance are not registered in the normal way, for the flowing in of love coming from God draws us beyond ourselves into communion in our most intimate dwelling place. John of Ruysbroek, a Flemish mystic, the 14th century, wrote a book called A Mirror of Eternal Blessedness. See if this attracts you. Desire and affection will make your heart expand so that you love, thank and praise God, and yet fall short in all this, for all that you're able to do seems as little or nothing compared to what you wish to do and what love will rightly demand of you. Through such desire, your heart suffers a painful wound. We heard Teresa talking about that earlier. And the sculpture of the angel piercing Teresa's heart. The pain constantly increases and is renewed through the practice of desirous affection for God, so that you grow weak from love. Sometimes it seems that your heart and your senses are broken to pieces, that your nature dies and comes to naught through the impatience of its desires, and that this impatience will have to last as long as you live. And he continues, but then, when you least expect it, it seems that God hides and withdraws God's hand, placing between God and you a darkness that you're not able to see through. You then lament, moan, and groan like a poor, abandoned exile. And he quotes the prophet, now are the poor abandoned to God. This teaching of Teresa and now John and John Ruysbroeck, they're all saying something to encourage us not to stop because it's dark. Because it's dark, because we're in very close communion with God, who is beyond our apprehension. Here's Therese of the Child Jesus and the Holy Face. Therese Martin joined the Carmelite convent in Lisieux in 1888 and died 9 years later. In a letter composed the year after her entry, she wrote, God prefers leaving me in darkness to giving me a false light which would not be God's. The following year, in 1890, she wrote, Jesus took me by the hand and made me enter a subterranean passage where I see nothing but a half-veiled light, the light which was diffused by the lowered eyes of my fiancé's face. Is the betrothal. My fiancé says nothing to me, and I say nothing to him, except that I love him more than myself. So there's this very young woman writing like this, experiencing this. A year before her death, Therese wrote, if at times you seem to hide yourself, it is you yourself who come to help me search for you. I don't know whether she'd ever read the sermon of Pope Gregory the Great on the Mass of the Mary of Magdala, but it's right there. You were helping me search for you. She continues the same theme just months before her death. And I quote, if you leave me deprived of your caress, I will not cease to smile. In peace, I will wait for your return and never stop praying my canticles of love. She's quite an extraordinary saint, a modern saint, and she talks about the little way. We can all do what Therese did, you know. She's not highfalutin or whatever. She's just right in touch with it, with truth. A contemporary of hers and another Carmelite, Elizabeth of the Trinity, Elizabeth Cartes joined the convent in Dijon in 1901 and died in 1906, so she was only 5 years in the convent. A letter written the year of her entry includes the following. It's no longer a veil, but a thick wall which hides God from me. I find it hard after having felt God so near, but I'm ready to remain in this state as long as it pleases my beloved to leave me in it. For faith tells me that my beloved is there all the same. Of what use are consolations and sweetness in the senses? That's not God. And it's God alone that we seek. So let us go to God in pure faith. In her last retreat, just before her death, she wrote, "I ought to plunge into the sacred darkness, keeping all my powers in night and emptiness. Then I will meet my master, and the light which clothes him as a garment will enwrap me too with his light alone." These writings are meant to encourage all of us when the time comes, whenever it is for each, not to be frightened by the dark, because the darkness is actually letting go whatever is not God and entering into the transcendent mystery. Teresa of Jesus, Teresa of Avila, "The darkness brings its own special suffering. First and foremost is the suffering caused by the profound but passing touch of God's love. This passing is a cause of pain, the pain of longing for the union to be granted again." She writes, "It's as though from the fire enkindled in the brazier that is my God, a spark leaps forth and so struck me that the flaming fire was felt by me." The spark, however, was not enough to set her on fire, hence the loving pain of longing. Setting on fire will be the marriage, which we'll talk about tomorrow morning. She writes, "We're left so full of longings to enjoy completely the one who grants these wonderful favours that we love in a great though delightful torment that we live. Everything we see wearies us. When alone, we find some relief. Yet, when we do not experience this pain, something is felt to be missing." She writes, "We feel a strange solitude because no creature in all the earth provides us company, not being the one we love. We're like a person hanging. We cannot support ourselves on any earthly thing, nor can we ascend into heaven. On fire with this thirst, we cannot get to the water, and the thirst is not one that is endurable, but already at such a point that nothing will take it away. Nor do we desire that it be taken away, save by that water of which the Lord spoke to the Samaritan woman. Yet," she writes, "no one gives us such water. No one can, except God when we're ready." So she's thirsty. Frequently cited by the mystics are the words of the Song of Songs, "I sought him, but I did not find him. I called to him, but he did not answer." It's all beyond words. Marie-Eugène writes, "Divine wisdom reveals herself so as to set us on fire, and hides herself so as to fan the flames of our desires, crushes us to make us docile, and wounds us to so as to heal. Thus, divine wisdom purifies, transforms, and quietens us." And these are my own words here. "God seems silent, hidden, absent. This is so that with our heart thus pierced and hurt by desire, we may finally open up to God with a greater capacity for receiving God." This is a recurring theme in spiritual writing, as we've already seen in earlier reflections. Over and above this pain of unfulfilled longing, there are other causes for suffering that can accompany the deepening of contemplative prayer. And I'm drawing here on Teresa's writings in the Interior Castle, the sixth dwelling place. And she, some of these seem a little bit strange to me, but I'm not a 16th century woman, and I'm not Teresa, and neither are you. So we're all got to find our own way here. "We can be afflicted by others accusing of posing to be holy." Well, thank God no one's ever accused me of that. For fairly obvious reasons, I think. And I doubt if you've been accused of it. But she was, it appears. "So we can be afflicted by others accusing us of posing to be holy, or by our own imagining that this is what we are doing. We start to think we're getting holy. We can also be afflicted by others praising us when we know that all is gift, and that gratitude to God and not praise of ourselves is the proper response to grace. We don't make a big deal of it. Just don't take it too seriously. They're really praising God. Well, just let it go. Let them praise God. These disturb us." Well, they may not disturb you, but they did her, obviously. "These disturb us because we're not at all sure of ourselves. We're wondering, well, maybe we are posing. Maybe we are deceived. We have to learn to take both blame and praise, this is good, lightly, and quickly turn from them to God. A good laugh wouldn't hurt you." When I came here to the novitiate, I must have been a serious young man. One of my brothers, who's a priest, died 10 years ago. He said to me, "Mick," he said, "every day," he said, "sit on the end of your bed and laugh at yourself." So I remember that, and that's 60 years ago, or a bit more, something like 60 years ago. So he must have thought I needed to do it. Maybe we do too, all of us. "We can find ourselves being misunderstood by a spiritual director." That can be painful. "Who may be incapable of giving us wise help." Therese suffered from priests like me and others here for a long time, till she ditched them, really. And I mean, she saw they were wrong. We can all be wrong. And they weren't listening to her experience. They were talking out of books, I suppose. Anyhow, "We can find ourselves being misunderstood by a spiritual director who may be incapable of giving us wise help. We can be disturbed by thoughts that we're being deceived and that we're deceiving others, because we know our faults a bit and others mightn't see them. Our reason may assure us this is not the case, but reason is powerless to help against these thoughts." She found it so. She writes, "If the Lord has granted you the touch of his love, you should thank him very much. You do not have to fear deception. Your only fear is that you might prove ungrateful for so generous a gift. So strive to better your entire life and to serve. Here she is, a practical, lovely woman. Look after other people. Do something lovely for someone. We can experience pain because of our sins. Teresa writes, suffering over one's sins increases the more one receives from God. Some of us, depends on your temperament, we can sin with a lot of vigour. You know, a bit to this and a bit to that, and we don't even notice it. You come stumbling and someone's walking all over you, but they don't see it. And as we become more and more sensitive, I'll tell you this now that it comes into my mind. I was a newly ordained priest. I'm 24, for God's sake, and I'm at Kensington. And one of the old priests, I don't remember who it was, and he's well and truly in heaven by now, anyhow, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, would you hear my confession? And I said, well, yes. Seemed a bit odd, him, anyhow. I didn't think too much about it. I went to the confessional, and he started his confession. And he said, he confessed sins of pride. And I can absolutely remember accurately my response. I had two responses. The first one was silly, because I was 24. And the other was wise beyond my years. The silly one was, what's he talking about? He's the humblest bloke in the community. And here he is confessing pride. And the second thought came quite quickly, my guardian angel maybe. Anyhow, the second thought came, of course, if he's humble, that's exactly what you do. You confess pride. Because your sin, he is so sensitive of the least movement of not being humble that I don't even notice. You maybe not notice. That's why he's confessing, because he's sensitive to the slightest bit of it. And that was a good thought, and I hope it taught me something. God's favours, writes Teresa, are like the waves of a large river in that they come and go. Excuse me, Teresa, I'm not sure they come and go. Our awareness of them ebbs and flows. God is constant. God isn't... Pardon me, Teresa. God loves me. But anyhow, these are her way of looking at it. God's favours are like the waves of a large river in that they come and go. But the memory these people have of their sins clings like a thick mire. And we become more sensitive of them. Obviously, the closer to God we get, we realise, God, that was, we knew it was bad, but we see how really bad it is. Now, we're not supposed to keep looking at it. You know that there are symbols, the stories in the gospel, but they're quite lovely. There's, you know, look at the difference, and I'm not, anyhow, the difference between Judas and Peter. Was Judas' sin worse than Peter's? Was Peter's sin worse than Judas? They're silly thoughts, and we haven't the faintest idea. What was the difference as they're presented to us in the gospel story? The difference is that when Judas realised he'd sinned, he looked in, and he couldn't get it out of his head how sinful he'd been, and he went and hanged himself, threw the money back, went and hanged himself. And someone who hangs themselves must surely be so close to God. They must be so desperate. That's where God goes. So that's why we... Yeah, for now. So whatever of Judas. But Peter didn't. When Peter sinned, he went out and wept, but he looked across the courtyard and caught Jesus' eye. And so he became aware of his sin, but he became aware of the immense forgiveness and love that was bigger than any sin he could possibly even think of. And that's true for all of us. So he was he looked at Jesus, which is what they're all telling us to do. It always seems that these sins are alive in the memory, and we can't forget who we've hurt. As long as we don't implode, as long as we, like the prodigal son, let the Father embrace you for God's sake. And if you feel awkward about getting dancing shoes and trinkets and crowns and cloaks and everything, we'll put up with it because your Father can't stop himself. God is now working in us for our final purging, purifying from all imperfections, till all that's left in your life, in my life, all that's left is love. Wouldn't that be good? When all resistance to love is conquered, when we've finally surrendered to love, then and only then there is experienced the peace of being fully in God's love. We should pray for that. Be ready for it. John of the Cross writes, "The dark night," and I hope by now you're not taking dark as bad. Dark's beautiful because you can't now look at anything else except God. And you can't see God, but you know that a night is beautiful. The dark night is a certain flowing in of God into the human creature, which purges us of the ignorance and imperfections belonging to our very nature. God teaches us in a strange, secret way, educating us to perfect love. It's God who does this. The creature can only be lovingly attentive, listening the way you would in the dark, receptive, allowing itself to be enlightened without understanding how. And John of the Cross also writes, "There's nothing in contemplation or the divine inflow which of itself gives pain." God isn't giving any pain. It's just painful being purified just to love. God's not doing it. We just, some might need it. Therese and Lisieux seem to get there pretty quickly. Some people are saints when they're seven and stay that way. I don't know how they did it, but anyhow, they do. "There's nothing in contemplation or the divine inflow which is of itself gives pain. Contemplation, rather, bestows sweetness and delight." Don't be surprised by it. "The cause for not experiencing these agreeable effects in our week is our weakness and imperfection at the time, our inadequate preparation, and the qualities we possess which are contrary to this light, habits we've formed, etc. Because of these, we have to suffer when the divine light shines upon us." And doesn't Paul say, "I rejoice in my suffering"? With the prayer of union comes a need for a psychological revolution in which we have to learn to surrender to God in our intellect and our will. We have to learn to surrender to God and be guided by God in the depths of our being. And we wouldn't know how to do any of this except we keep watching Jesus do it. And thank God we've got some mystics who show the way a bit, point the way. When we experience this darkness in the core of our being, we must learn to receive rather than determine our own activity. We're so used to being active, even in our searching for God and in our commitment to prayer. In this enforced passivity, it will seem to us that God has abandoned us and left us in darkness. Our intellect and our will are being purified till there's no longing in us except to be with God and to do God's holy will. And of course, if you're with God, you're with everyone. You're with the cosmos. There's no limit because God's everywhere. So this isn't an isolated being with God and not. There's no not in this. But being with God means you are at the heart of reality. God is digging out the deep roots of sin, consuming us and purging us in order to recreate us in the pure fire of divine love. I'll read to you from this extraordinary book, the Book of Lamentations. There are five, if my memory is correct, and the first two and the fourth and fifth are all of a piece. The third one stands out uniquely, and I'll do my best to read it to you, but it's very beautiful. Like, it's extraordinary. If you're feeling crook, read Lamentations chapter 3. And you'll think, I don't feel too bad at all, really. And you'll see why. You'll see why. This is the writer, Jerusalem destroyed, temple gone, king gone, everything in a wreck. No trade, no comfort, no nothing. The place has been, the countryside has been set alight by the Babylonians. There's not enough to eat and all that. I'm one, says the author, who has seen affliction under the rod of God's wrath. He understands God, as does Jeremiah, wrongly. They think this is all God's destroying Jerusalem because they sinned. Now that's an image of God you can't but pick up if you read the Old Testament scriptures. But if you stop with reading the Old Testament scriptures and stay with that image, Jesus is there saying, it was said to you of old, but I say to you. There's a revolution happening. Anyhow, let's stay within the limits of their thinking. I'm one who's seen affliction under the rod of God's wrath. God has driven and brought me into darkness without any light, he thinks. Against me alone, God turns God's hand. We can feel like this. Again and again, all day long. God has made my flesh and my skin waste away and broken my bones, has besieged and enveloped me with bitterness and tribulation, has made me sit in darkness like the dead of long ago. God has walled me about so that I can't escape, has put heavy chains on me. And though I call and cry for help, God shuts out my prayer and blocks my way with hewn stones. God has made my paths crooked. God is a bear lying in wait for me, a lion in hiding. God led me off my way and tore me to pieces. God has made me desolate, has bent the bow and set me as a mark for God's arrow. God shot into my vitals the arrows of his quiver. I've become the laughing stock of all my people, the object of their taunt songs all day long. God has filled me with bitterness, sated me with wormwood. God has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. I'm bereft of peace. I've forgotten what happiness is. And so I say, gone is my glory and all that I'd hoped for from the Lord. The thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. I continually think of it and am bowed down. is not fair really for me to do this to you. I read that bit, hoping you'll go back and then read what follows. Because it's stunningly beautiful. That's how he feels about God. But then he experiences beyond that something better. Teresa knows how gentle we must be with a person suffering the pain of God's purifying love. Oh, Jesus, she writes, how sad it is to see a person thus forsaken. And you may very well feel like that author of Lamentations 3. Of course you might. Jesus did. My God, why have you forsaken me? This suffering makes us more tender, more compassionate for others, more open to love. We learn to identify we learn to identify with Jesus in his cry, my God, and don't miss the my. He's my God, he hasn't lost that. Why have you abandoned me? Marie Eugène writes, by a painful experience of our own weakness, of the depths of sin in ourselves and in others, of the hateful power of sin in the world, of its blind violence in all people, we learn humility before God, before ourselves, and before the work to be realized in the church. We progressively discover the human divine conditions in which the kingdom of God, the reign of God, is built up here below, the part of God in it and the part that we are to play. The efficacious power of divine love, the indulgent and silent patience that this love requires of the human instrument, if we would triumph over the forces of sin. Teresa knew that and gave all her, she never had good health, but what health she had, she gave, and she, and all her energy was extraordinary. She wrote to the Emperor, Holy Roman Emperor, and didn't muck around. You ever thought of writing to the Holy Roman Emperor? Mm-hmm. You might write to Trump and give him some thoughts. But anyhow, she did. She was into anything that would progress the church, the community. Our experience at this time is one of light and darkness. The measure of each depends on our need for purification and on the courage with which we open ourselves to God's purifying love. And John of the Cross writes, we never remain in the same state for long. Remember, Therese, all things passing. We never remain in the same state for long, but are continually up and down. This is because we cannot be in the state of perfection, which consists in perfect love of God and contempt of self in comparison, without knowing God and ourselves. And so we're given a taste of one, that is exaltation, and then a taste of the other, humiliation. It's when the fire is less purifying that we experience more the enkindling of love. Listen to John of the Cross. This enkindling of love is not always felt by us, but only at times when contemplation assails us less vehemently. For then we have occasion to see and even enjoy the word which is being wrought in us and revealed to us. For it seems that the worker takes his hand from the work and draws the iron out of the furnace. Why? In order that something of the work that's being done may be seen by us. And again, Marie Eugène We must be on our guard against any stereotyped notion of the dark night. The night is always an intervention of divine wisdom by fire. The divine bellows fan to ablaze the depths of our being with a force and rhythm as varied as are the designs of God for us and as are the forms of sin of which we must be purified. The dark night, he goes on to say, is a realm of suffering, but also one of peace. A realm where love wounds painfully and with violence, but only to purify, to liberate, to heal, and bring us into transforming union. A valuable caution is offered here by Ruth Burroughs, an English Carmelite, who warns us. This is pretty clever, and she tells us not to beware of imagined suffering. Real suffering, she says, check this for yourself, real suffering is received moment by moment and is always bearable. We're all here this morning. So whatever suffering happened in your life, you can still kick a football, or maybe not. You're still alive. So it hasn't actually killed you, because you're here. Real suffering. And we can multiply it, can't we? We can look at it through different coloured glasses. No, real suffering is received moment by moment, and it's always bearable. You and I are the proof of it. A further clarification is offered in a Carmelite commentary on the teachings of John of the Cross. It's called God Speaks in the Night. And see if this makes sense to you. I'm going to conclude with this and then offer you some music and then come back to the topic tomorrow morning. They write, "The dark night is not the trials and afflictions, fears and temptations coming from the world. Nor is it the temptations, dryness, and afflictions from the senses. Nor is it the tribulations, darkness, distress, abandonment, temptations, and other trials in our intellect and will. The dark night isn't any of those. It's the attitude one has in dealing with them. This means interpreting the facts in faith, responding with love, bearing them, or seeking a solution with hope in God, the three theological virtues. They're not virtues we can acquire. These are the gifts of God: faith, hope, and love. The dark night is a grace from God, but one which we must live with much effort."